Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2003, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is an actor and a writer. She was born in a Midlands mining village to a family which had emigrated from the Punjab. A dutiful daughter and clever, she went to the local girls' high school and then to Manchester University. She'd pretended she'd like to become a doctor, but secretly she'd always yearned to write and perform. She didn't have to wait long. She was snapped up by the Royal Court Theatre in London, and before she was 30, she'd written a three-part series for the BBC. And then came the big one, Goodness Gracious Me, transferred from Radio 4 to BBC 2, and it became an instant hit. The same brand of humour is now getting good ratings in The Kumars at number 42. She's the grandma. All this success represents a coming of age for Asian culture in Britain today, and she is at the heart of it. Brown is the new black, she's claimed. Not entirely seriously, I suspect. And more in earnest, she said, cultural schizophrenia made my whole generation sparky and creative. She is Meera Syal. Or perhaps you were serious about Brown is the New Black, I'm not sure. But tell me, you know, how did it manifest itself? When do you feel it became trendy to be Asian?
Ooh, I can't put an exact date on it, but I would say around about the time of Goodness Gracious Me.
So it's the last 5-7 years, hmm?
Yes, there was a sudden flowering of my generation that had been born and brought up here, but obviously had Indian or Pakistani parents. Unlike our parents, we regard this as home. And we weren't just going to be passive onlookers in society. We were part of it, and we found a voice and wanted to express that creatively. And Goodness Gracious Me kind of encapsulated that kind of statement. We're brown, we're proud, and we're here. I think that's what people picked up on.
So you get, I mean, and it did become the classic, didn't it, about the Indian yobs going into the English restaurant as opposed to vice versa.
Absolutely, that has become a classic, going for an English, which was a complete role reversal. Very, very simple idea. It's a bunch of young Indians going to an English restaurant in Bombay, asking for the blandest thing on the menu and calling the waiter Clive of India. And I think suddenly it held up this mirror to British society. And there was a feeling that, oh, my God, is that how we behave in your restaurants? Yes, we do. Oh, my God, and you noticed? And I think a lot of Goodness Gracious Me worked on that level, that it was affectionate, but it was quite pointed. It was an admittance that, you know, you have your prejudices, we have ours, we can laugh at you, we can also laugh at ourselves. So it's a very fair show in that way.
And now, of course, we have Bombay Dreams on in the West End, Andrew Lloyd Webber producing. I mean, is that a symbol of having arrived, this culture having arrived?
Well, I think if you'd said even 5 years ago that there was going to be a successful West End musical based on Bollywood with an all-Asian cast, I certainly wouldn't have believed it. Things have happened quite rapidly.
But is it a one-off, you know? I mean, are we going to have another one in 2 years' time, or perhaps we don't get another one for 10 years, you know?
I doubt it.
It's just a fashion.
It could be in some ways. I think certainly, you know, that whole statement about Brown being the new black, well, I was slightly cynical when I said it. Nobody wants to be flavour of the month. I don't. And when the fashion's over, we're all still going to be here. But I think if you're smart, you use it to some extent. You use the fact that people are suddenly interested in other influences, cultural influences. But after that, if you survive, that is really up to what you produce and your talent.
Words will survive. You've got a word now in the Oxford English Dictionary that you've invented, have you? Chuddies.
Well, I didn't invent it. It was the two Bunga muffins in Goodness Gracious Me, yes. The phrase, kiss my chuddies. It's like the Bart Simpson Indian thing, eat my shorts. Yes, chuddies got into the Oxford English Dictionary, which means you can legitimately use it next time you play Scrabble, sir.
Chuddy. C-H-U-D-D-I-E-S.
I-E-S, yeah.
OK, first record. Tell me about that one.
This is a song by a fantastic musician called Nitin Sawhney. Nitin mixes classical Indian influences with jazz, and the result is fresh, beautiful, and sometimes confrontational.
If I could set the sun,
Nitin Sawhney's Sunset. So, Meera Sahyal, we've had this explosion, really, of Asian humour, whether it's Goodness Gracious Me or the Kumars at number 42, suddenly attracting a mainstream white audience. What do you think? What have you done differently that's made that audience come to it? What is it that the white audience likes about that humour or finds attractive?
I think the main thing was that it was unapologetic. It came at the end of a long period of political correctness where people became very scared of writing Asian characters that were anything but noble and long-suffering. Very boring to play, I have to tell you. And here we came along going, well, you know, we don't know if it makes you laugh. It makes us laugh. There's a bit of Hindi in it. We don't really care if you don't get it or not. I mean, we had nothing to lose.
Because your observations of your family or the nature of Indian culture or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the humour is family-based, and it really came from us sitting down as a group, sharing weird stuff that had happened in our childhoods.
Like what? Give me an example.
Well, you know, I'd turn around and say, do your parents keep suitcases on top of the wardrobe and have plastic on the sofa? And everyone would go, yes! What's that about? And also relatives. I mean, relatives are a huge source of humour.
The aunties and the uncles.
Oh, we've
keep
exploited
coming.
Them shamelessly, and they should be very annoyed with us, but... That was another route of it.
So I mean, you've even had them, you know, endlessly getting out of tiny motor cars, great sort of hordes of aunties wrapped in saris.
Yes, that was my childhood. I mean, we grew up communally, and I loved it actually. But
quite shocking for a white audience, in the sense that you will make jokes like, "How many Asian women does it take to change a light bulb?"
Yes, you know what the answer is. Don't worry about me, I'll sit in the dark.
Exactly.
Which apparently works with Jewish women too. I have Jewish mothers, I'm told, by my Jewish friends. But there's the root of why Goodness Gracious Me worked. At the end of the day, it was very universal humour, and the best humour is, however culturally specific you are, the humour that really works. It works because it's funny and it touches something that we all recognise.
It works because it's genuine. And there's a lot in common, is there not, with the kind of Indian culture and the Jewish culture. There's the mother thing very much at the centre.
Absolutely. Mothers, guilt, food, spoiling your sons. We are the same people separated by a tan, really. Very similar to Indians. We can be found all over the world with the suitcases on top of the wardrobe and the plastic on the sofa.
Listen, we all have suitcases.
It's a portable
on top
culture.
Of the wardrobe. I don't know whether it's a particularly Indian or Jewish thing. But
it's a Midland thing. So.
Perhaps it is. You never know. But how much do you think, I mean, obviously the ability to poke fun at yourself and of course you can do it if it's genuine. I mean, it's much more difficult for Bernard Manning to do it, it seems to me. I mean, you know, or if you're blacked up in any way. I mean, you can only do it if you are it, can't you?
Absolutely. It's a difference between impersonation and being honest, talking from your experience.
But if all of that feeds into helping fuel the popularity of Asian culture, which we are now saying has come of age, how much does it help combat racism?
I think it does an awful lot. I think that a well-placed joke can probably do as much good as 3 hours of a political speech, because once you understand a group of people emotionally, it's much harder for you to dismiss them as them.
Record number two.
I had to choose this record from one of my favourite films, Monsoon Wedding. This whole song is taken from a scene where it's the girls' hen night and all the female relatives are sitting around singing rather rude songs about the groom. These were the same songs that I grew up with. I remember my auntie sitting around singing these songs. At that point, didn't know what they were singing. Now I do, and I'm quite shocked. I wish I'd had a translator then.
Mendi Madarama Pincha from the film Monsoon Wedding, performed by Madan Bala Sindhu. So, I mean, I got Calvin Klein and Malt Whiskey in there, but what were your aunties singing about then when you were little that shocked you so much?
Oh, well, they were quite rude.
Like what? Tell me.
I'm not sure I can say I'm ready for Sue. What you'd expect from ladies on a hen night. I mean, you know, not pornographic, but there was a lot of double entendre, a lot of jokes about, well, tomorrow night you're going to find out what it's all about being a married woman, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, given that my aunties were these very serene, well-behaved, proper ladies, it was amazing to see on occasions like that, their sense of wicked fun.
But they weren't necessarily your aunties. I mean, auntie is one of those words, isn't
it? Oh, it's a generic term.
Yes.
Any older woman was an auntie.
Yes. And they all used to come round. So, in a sense, this house that you lived in, which is a little terraced house with a lavatory in the yard, mining village, was kind of Little India itself, was it, inside the house? But outside, this is the schizophrenia, isn't
yes.
it? Outside, you've got this whole kind of Midlands industrial working class culture.
Absolutely. I would literally have to swap accents and attitudes. You know, inside the house, I was very well behaved and I would talk about my studies and I would help my mother in the kitchen. And then outside the house, I'd be talking like this and then going down the park. Yeah, I'm a wench, just like you. Can I try your shoes on?
And did you have a girl next door, as in your novel, Anita and Me, who was sort of curvy and blonde and everything you weren't and wanted to be?
There were a bunch of older girls that I kind of amalgamated into Anita who I absolutely worshipped. And I would pathetically follow them round in my mum's slingbacks and tissue stuffed down my vest, hoping that they'd let me into the gang. But luckily, I think I realised, you know, through that relationship, as Mina does in the book, that there are points where they will never be friends. Because as Mina and as I realised really where I was coming from, it became clear that that friendship couldn't survive it.
But Mina was trying to, therefore, in order to become part of the gang, part of the wenches, deny who she was. Is that what you tried to do?
Yeah, I think you do go through a stage. It's something.
Except that you were this other thing as well. That's the point, isn't it? When you've been born in this country then and you're going to school with these kids, even though you're in the minority, you are part of them. And that's the dilemma, isn't it? Who are you?
It's the dilemma, and you do have to sort out quite early on who you are, or you are going to face a life of self-hatred.
And you did a lot of that, huh?
Not as much as a lot of other friends, because really mainly because of my parents, who were so laid back and so loving and really instilled a sense of pride in me quite early on.
But the pride, I mean, would be there anyway, and I wanted to ask you about that, because your parents, although they lived in this very working-class area, I mean, your parents were professionals. Your mother was a teacher, your father was an accountant. So that although they were friendly with the neighbours, there was, again, a sense in Anita and Me of keeping their precious daughter apart from this kind of influence around.
I wouldn't say apart, but all their friends were Hindu Punjabi. They knew who they felt comfortable with. And you have to remember that our parents took the brunt of the whole immigration and adaptation process. I can't imagine the kind of struggle and racism they went through.
Well, indeed, and we're talking, what, a few miles from Wolverhampton, where Enoch Powell made his Rivers of Blood speech.
That's why the suitcases were on top of the wardrobe, because we had to run away very, very quickly, I think. I think that was symbolic of that. I know I've only got a glimpse, actually, into what they went through.
I want to ask you some more about that, but let's pause for record number three.
Bob and Marcy are Young, Gifted and Black. This was the first song I remember hearing that actually was talking about pride, self-pride, racially. And my abiding memory of certainly this song is watching a bunch of white Midland girls all bopping along and singing, "Oh, yeah, I'm young, gifted and black." And I thought, you know, if music can do that, I'm all for it.
Young, gifted and black. Oh, how I long to know the truth. There were times when I look back, and I am haunted by my youth. Oh, but my joy of today is that we can all be proud to say, to be young, gifted and black is where it's at.
Bob and Marcia and Young, Gifted and Black. So, Mira Sal, there was a lot of angst about identity. How painful did it get? I mean, what about at school? And were you the butt of any kind of taunt?
Oh, yeah, that was kind of... You took that as rote. It was the experience of all immigrant kids growing up in Britain.
Mm. But there was a moment, wasn't there, when you cut your finger that was quite telling?
Oh, that was at infant school, yeah. I did. I cut my finger on one of those silver milk bottle tops, you know, in those days you used to get school milk. All the kids gathered around because they were amazed that my blood was red. And that's when I was only about four, and I thought, my God, they really think we're an alien race. Mm. They don't even think that my blood would be the same colour. And that was kind of typical of a lot of the racism, certainly in the late 60s when I was at infant school, because it was curiosity and it was fascination and it was ignorance. It wasn't vicious. It's really later on in the mid-70s, late-70s, when I was a teenager, with the rise of the National Front, that the racism changed from that kind of curiosity to just nastiness, a deliberate nastiness. So there was a change in the tone.
But your parents would have known it. Your parents would have felt the resonance of the politics of the time, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. They were in the front line. All our parents were. I don't remember the Rivers of Blood speech in 68, but certainly I remember my mum and dad talking about it. I also remember them talking about, around about the same time, there was a Tory MP in Birmingham who was campaigning under the slogan, "If you want a nigger for a neighbour, vote Labour," which was kind of extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And then you understand, when you put it in context like that, you really understand why our parents' generation did decide to stick together and were clannish and were protective.
Why do you say, and I quoted you at the beginning as saying this, that all of that experience made you creative and sparky?
Lots of different reasons. Firstly, that I was asked very early on, you know, who I thought I was. Where do you come from? Why don't you go back to where you come from? These are questions that most people never have to think about. I had to think about them at a very early age. So quite early on, you are questioning your sense of belonging and identity and how you're going to express that. That's my theory personally of why so many of my generation have turned to different art forms, because very early on, we had to go, this is who I am, this is what I think, this is how I'm going to express it.
Next piece of music.
Joni Mitchell was a huge influence on my student days. There's something so vulnerable and painfully beautiful about her voice that takes me right back to those days, really.
Oh, you're in my blood like holy wine. It tastes so bitter and so sweet. Oh, I could think a case of you.
Joni Mitchell and A Case of You. So you'd been a good girl, Mary. You'd passed your 11 plus.
Oh, yes.
To Walsall Girls High School.
Queen Mary's High School for Girls. Still going.
Covered in ivy and smelling of furniture polish. Classic girls high. Hmm?
Absolutely. Even we had cloisters and everything, yeah.
How smart.
Yes, it was. It was a very big deal. And the uniforms were pretty amazing too. And those, we had to wear tam o'shanters. That was compulsory. You were fined if you didn't wear your woolly tartan hat on the way home. You can imagine how popular that made it with the other kids in the area.
And then you went off to Manchester University to read English and drama, not medicine, which presumably your parents were disappointed about that.
No, I think they gave up when I was about 13, when it became clear that I was squeamish at the sight of blood and couldn't do maths. I think they just gave up gracefully and made a very wise decision, realised that I had an aptitude for languages and arts.
But that was quite a statement on your part, wasn't it, to decide to do that?
And on theirs to let me do it, because they realised if I loved something, then I'd probably do it well. So.
Now, you've described yourself as an outsider, as it were, along the way. Am I not right in thinking there was another reason you were a bit of an outsider in all this, because you were also quite large by this stage, right?
Quite large. You're pretty, very delicately, Sue.
Mm-hmm. OK, so you were a fatty.
I was of a certain stature, yes, as a teenager.
Didn't your mother put you on a diet? I mean,
oh, she tried. But that's the thing, it becomes a battleground. It is actually about self-esteem. And the minute you stop worrying about it, the weight actually comes off.
So what was the miraculous moment when, you know, the weight fell from you and you knew who you were? What happened to bring that about?
I think it was just when I started to do what I really had wanted to do all my life, probably. I think it was the end of years of hoping and frustration. I just felt so grateful to be studying a subject, two subjects that I'd adored and never thought I'd get a chance to do. And it wasn't that I was a swot, really. It was actually that I just was so passionate about literature and about performing and never thought I'd ever get the chance to do it, that I absolutely threw myself into all the productions I could get my hands on.
And then there was this big one, wasn't there, that went to Edinburgh and was a great success, the one-woman play,
yeah,
One of Us.
Yes, that was the break, I suppose. I mean, I was meant to be going on to do an MA, and then this one-woman show went to Edinburgh and got spotted by a director at the Royal Court, and I was offered an equity card. And I thought, this is ridiculous. I can't not take this job and just find out if I'm any good at this. So from my life being mapped out completely, everything went to pot and I just went, okay, packed my bag and off I went to London.
Music.
Oh, the Kinks, Waterloo Sunset. Well, it somehow epitomised what I thought the capital was all about, and I still think it is the ultimate love song to London.
As long as I gaze on Waterloo Sunset, I am in paradise.
Kinks and Waterloo Sunset. You spent 7 years, I think, after university acting in the theatre, although you were writing bits and pieces at the same time. You were in Sue Townsend's Celestial Carol, you and Carol Churchill's Serious Minds.
I did some fantastic work, new work in the theatre, yeah.
But how many roles did you get that weren't specifically for an Asian actress?
Loads in the theatre.
You did?
Yeah, the theatre's always been way ahead of television and film. I think every single part I was ever called up for, certainly when I put a toe into television, was specifically for an Asian part. Mostly, you know, either Mrs. Patel with three lines in the corner shop, or victim of arranged marriage, or maybe, you know, woman in Raj quartet kind of fantasy. Relentlessly unchallenging, really, and such a contrast to the work I was doing in the theatre, and also to the kind of women that I knew and I grew up with. And I thought, you know, I don't recognise these creations as the women I know.
I wonder why television was so far behind.
It still is. It's got a little better, but I would still say that three quarters of the time it still does say Asian on the script. Not that one doesn't want to play a good Asian part. The difference is the Asian parts are good now.
You mentioned arranged marriages earlier on. You tried that once, didn't you?
No, my grandfather tried to hitch me up. Yeah, I went to India for the first time on my own when I was 22. I arrived to find three sacks of mail sitting in my granddad's little front room.
He'd advertised you, hadn't he?
Yeah, without my permission, in the Hindustan Times. He said, well, I thought you were coming over, you know, and, you know, we might as well. I said, you didn't put British passport in the ad, did you, Grandad? Well, yes, I mentioned it. I thought, oh, no. That's why there's three sacks of mail. Actually, I've still got some of the letters. Fantastic material.
But did you meet any of the men?
Yes, I did. I mean, I'm really not against it. I think arranged marriage can work if you're in that right zone. However, what I couldn't cope with is the fact that at the end of one meeting, these Indian men did think, well, now we need to know. And I thought, you know, I need a bit more time than 2 hours at a hotel having a coffee, really.
So they take you home and propose, would they?
They proposed in the taxi on the way back from the first date. Yeah. And it was very valuable for me because I really did know by the end of that experience, this method was not for me. Not that it doesn't work for anybody else, but that was a part of me that couldn't adapt.
That being who you were, you couldn't kind of wrench 1,000 years of Indian culture into you in 1990s Britain, I suppose.
No, and I think the hang-up that I've got rid of, and I got rid of it because I went to India, is that, you know, one's definition of Indian and being a good Indian woman is so subjective. I was brought up a certain way. You know, I was told that good Indian girls did this, that and the other. I go to India, and the first thing my cousin said to me when I got off the plane is, God, what are you wearing? It's old-fashioned, yard. And I thought, oh, you're wearing jeans. And I put my Indian suit on. Come on, let's go and have pizza. Oh, actually, I felt like eating some Indian food. Oh, God, no. You know, and suddenly your whole perceptions of what it means to be Indian completely goes upside down.
Well, yours were your parents' generation, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Haven't allowed for India to move on.
India has moved on incredibly. It's more sophisticated in places than we are over here. You go to Bangalore, it's like some high-tech silicon chip city. And that is why it's so important to keep going back, because you can get stuck in this immigrant bubble where you have your definitions of what your culture is. Your culture is moving on without you. And I met some incredible women out there who really got rid of that whole hang-up. You know, I'm an Indian woman. I'm also British. I find the two greatly integrated. And I don't measure myself by anybody else's standards. Now, I know it's a completely subjective definition.
I got number six.
Pizzicato 5 is this rather crazy Japanese jazz combo. And I love this song because it's got a real sense of fun. And it's the song that my daughter and I play when we're driving along on the school run, and incredibly she knows the whole chorus in Japanese, which I think means she's a very, very smart child and the education has not been wasted.
Staccato 5 with Twiggy Twiggy. And then, after everything, came Bombay Dreams, which you wrote the book of, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And now you're rewriting it because it's going to Broadway. How do you perceive the difference in the nature of the audience? What are you rewriting for, with what in mind?
The knowledge about Indian culture is a lot less for the American public. I mean, we really take for granted, actually, how much the British know about Asian culture now. You know, you can't even use a word like chapati freely in New York. I mean, and that's a sophisticated city. We're a very invisible little group over there. Powerful. There's a lot of very successful Indians. Mm. But culturally, they don't know that much about us. And so we just have to simplify it in ways, actually, just so that you know, they don't get too scared.
And in the meantime, the Kumars at number 42 goes from strength to strength. You play the grandma, as we know. Is it based on your grandma?
It's based on a number of amazing grannies that I've met, really, through my childhood and over the years, who, again, completely defied every stereotype you have of an older Indian woman, because generally an old woman is invisible in society. You're the least important member of society. And they've seen it all, done it all, and got the T-shirt, and nobody's going to tell them what to do anymore.
And indeed they don't with Granny Kumar.
No, and I just wanted to pay homage, really, to that whole bunch of women that have this incredible spirit and fun.
And who drool over Donny Osmond. And
because they can.
Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen.
Well, nobody takes the flirting seriously because it's a granny. Although, of course, you know, I am underneath all the makeup thinking, core, but, you know.
Well, quite, there we are. You have played quite a few older women, women older than yourself, you know, certainly the grandma, but, I mean, I'm also thinking about the auntie in Anita and Me,
yeah.
And a sort of middle-aged, over-the-hill showbiz journalist, Smita Smitten,
oh,
one
yes.
of your characters. When are you going to play, you know, what you are? When are you going to be offered, I suppose, a good, strong, 40-year-old, irrelevant if she's Asian, romantic lead?
That would be really nice. I mean, I do enjoy playing women without vanity. I think vanity for an actress is a killer, actually. The minute you start worrying about, does your bum look big in that, or is your lip liner all right, you're not really doing your job. And I think that's why I've been attracted to so many women that are quirky or unusual or just plain ugly. Because in a way, it's those women that have had to work twice as hard to be charismatic and interesting.
Record number 7.
I had to choose a song from Bombay Dreams, really, because it's been a big part of my life the last couple of years. And this song is a wedding kavali. A kavali is a very traditional Asian song which is structured around question and response and often gets very passionate. It's full of religious devotion. And Sukhvinder Singh, who sings this, certainly captures that.
A.R. Rahman's The Wedding Kavali from the stage show Bombay Dreams, performed by Sukhvinder Singh. How, Meera Sahil, how different is life for your daughter from the way it was for you? And again, one's thinking of the you character, Meena, in Anita and Me. How does your daughter, about the same age, of course, 10 years old, how does your daughter's life differ from hers?
Well, on a purely obvious and practical level, her classroom is like a meeting of the UN. that's incredibly different to how I grew up. My culture was a little hidden thing that I only shared with people inside my house. It wasn't reflected anywhere outside.
So she is third generation British Asian, is much more comfortable in her own skin. She knows who she is. She's more assimilated in every way, yes?
I think so, and also much more assimilated to the reality of life, certainly in London, is that London is many, many cultures, and she sees the interest and beauty in each one, and so do her friends, and I love that.
But also being the daughter of a successful Asian woman, then she's obviously mixing in rather more enlightened circles. As we know, there are still people out there. I mean, the BNP suddenly, you know,
absolutely,
makes huge inroads at the last local election. So, you know, it isn't all sweetness and light, is it?
Not at all. But that's why it's even more important, I think, that children like her are growing up with a compassion and an empathy for different voices.
Mm. But how do you think it will be for her children? Do you think multicultural Britain will truly then have arrived?
I suspect we could be into an ab-fab situation. My daughter may end up at 22 saying, "Mum, can you get me an arranged marriage, please? Because, you know, you're hopeless." You find that every generation wants to swing against the generation before. And I see pockets of that with, you know, young men particularly that decide to go into fundamentalism because that's what gives them a sense of identity. So it's very difficult to tell. I think all you can do with your children is offer them a cornucopia of choices and say, look, you come from an ancient and beautiful culture. Some bits of it are terrible and oppressive, and I don't expect you to think that's tradition, but it's up to you to decide which are the blessings that you want to take forward with you.
Last piece of music.
Louis Armstrong has a quite profound effect on me, and this particular song, I think, is just one of the most romantic songs ever written, and truly, if somebody sang this to me under my balcony, I would have to marry them.
And when you kiss me, heaven opens wide, and there you are, inviting me inside. The wonder angel that I'm starry-eyed. Fantastic, fantastic, that's you.
Louis Armstrong and Fantastic, That's You. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Mira, which one would you take?
I think it would have to be Young, Gifted and Black because it's got a positive message. It would keep me upbeat until I was rescued and I could jig about to it too and keep fit.
So the book, we give you complete works of Shakespeare. We give you the Bible, but you don't want the Bible, do you?
Well, I'd quite like to take the Bhagavad Gita, actually, which is the ancient Hindu text, just because I've never really studied that properly, and this would be a fantastic opportunity to actually read the whole thing.
OK, but what about your own book?
I'd like to take a Hindi-English dictionary, because my vocabulary is appalling. I can get through talking to relatives, but really I need to extend the yes, the no, and yes, I'd like another one of those, please. I'd like to have a bigger vocabulary, so I think I'll take that.
And your luxury?
A piano. I had 2 years of piano lessons, which I absolutely loved, and then they all stopped because my brother was born and life got very busy. And I've always regretted that I didn't continue, so I could finally get to...
It's going to be very self-improving on your
own. I know. I think it's the only way to survive it, really. Look forward to something and come off a better person, you know.
Mira Sal, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.